Three mates, three headlines, what's next?
We've got a good one coming. Episode 13, boys, and today we are heading north of the border. But first, as always, how are we both?
Good, thank you. Two Skybet promotional boosts coming in over the weekend, making lockdown three a little bit easier. Sean, how was your weekend?
Yeah, not bad. Working the weekend, but I think I'm just going to jump on the back of your betting soon, Jimmy, and put some money behind you.
It's a slippery slope. I'm massively down this year. Don't let this weekend fool you.
Well, there's always a chance, isn't there? Dyke, how's your weekend been?
Not too bad. Back home for a half term, so the snow's gone, which is a bit of a shame, so I missed most of that. But before we move on, we have got our headlines to round up, but I'm not feeling too many this week, so we can crack on with the more important content coming up. I've left a lot out, but some highlights still. Sean Dyche's head still scrambled from John McGinn as he tried to field an ineligible player in the Cup. Klopp finally concedes the title defence may be over. Ancelotti turned into a walking meme by blowing on his cuppa post-winner. Kyrgios is back to winning points with underarm aces. In the boxing, Josh Warrington was stunned, and in the UFC, Usman retained once again. The Gallagher Premiership scrapped relegation for this season. Ben Folkes showed the world what they've been missing with bat and gloves, proving me right. And Jimmy got Dom Best dropped, and now he's got Moeen heading home after one test. Lastly, England beat Italy by 23 points in the Six Nations, meaning I claim the points as nearest predicting 30. We had to accept Jimmy's first answer of 7 rather than his adapted 25.
I thought I was on for it when Italy went 1-0
up. 1-0 up in the rugby, Jimmy.
1-0.
Put your complaints in writing, Jimmy. But first, what is next?
We have had the joy of speaking to former Warwickshire, Durham, Derbyshire, Sussex and current Scotland cricketer Callum McLeod, who is also a massive golfing bandit and somehow a Man United glory-seeking football supporter. Joy to speak to Callum. Please enjoy yourselves.
Callum, first of all, thank you very much for joining us. And secondly, congratulations to yourself and Laura on the birth of your son. How are things? How is lockdown going with a month-old child?
It's been interesting. It's probably been the only good thing to come out of lockdown. The fact that I'm around and being able to spend this long with the little one, which probably normally wouldn't get. It's been hard work, but it's been rewarding.
And secondly, Cal, we were going to try and catch you last night, but you palmed us off quite quickly when Manu were on TV and you decided you'd rather watch that than speak to us. So we have so many questions that we'll gradually work our way through. But first of all, how on earth does a lad from Glasgow end up supporting Manu?
I suppose it's obviously the Ferguson connection. I think most Scottish people say that. And I grew up when they were winning everything, and you know what kids are like, they gravitate towards the team that are winning.
No one told me that.
Yeah, well.
There were a couple of quite successful teams in Glasgow at that time as well, Carl, that at least one of them would have been winning something, so.
I did support Celtic a little bit, but I suppose as I got older and older, I think Scottish League started to bore me a little bit. And watching United was certainly until about 7 years ago was a lot more exciting. It's been a bit more stressful recently, but this year we're gradually getting somehow Ollie's back at the wheel and he's steering us up the table somehow.
Do you think you'll win it this year?
I can't see it. City look too good. If City play well, I just think they're just a cut above, especially with Liverpool having some problems. Not scoring and stuff. I just can't see how United will sustain it. But I hope so.
Joking aside though, Carl, and I can't promise we won't keep bringing football up as it arises in the conversation, but as we say, football was so big in Glasgow, still is. How did cricket become your passion, your career? Where did it all start for you?
I suppose in Scotland there's two ways of doing it. East Coast is mostly school based, and then the West Coast where I grew up, it's a lot of clubs. It's a bit like the North East. They've got small little community cricket clubs, and I was lucky enough, my dad was a social member at Drumpellier Cricket Club, and he'd go over there on a Saturday to watch the game, and I'd just go along as a little boy and just enjoy it. Just, I think it's such a good place to be as a kid, because you're outside, just throwing, you're hitting, you're not worrying about too much. It's a good space, and I just think from there, once you start playing, it gets you hooked, doesn't it? It's a funny way, cricket.
You worked your way through, obviously you played a lot of junior cricket, playing men's cricket, and then when did you start to get involved in the Scotland setup? Because myself and James, we'll both remember playing Northumberland County cricket against Scotland as they were sort of involved in our region, so to speak, with it being on the border. Played a lot of cricket against players through the age groups there who have now played full Scotland even. But what was that pathway like at that stage?
It was quite a strong pathway, actually. It started, I think the earliest was under 12s, where we used to go to the Ampleforth Festival. Brilliant festival for young cricketers, which I'm not sure if it's still going. And then 13s, 15s, 17s, 19s. It's not that way now, but it was a lot of cricket through the summer. And to be honest, I just wanted to be involved. You just want to play as much cricket in as high as level as possible. And then just being involved in those setups. And I was quite lucky with coaches that were around at that time, had some links down to a couple of counties. And as soon as those doors started to open slightly, I just thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I've got a passion for the game, and I want to see how far I can take it.
As a Scottish lad, you've obviously got a little bit of a golf connection as well. We've played with you a few times, and from what I remember, you seem to hit it awfully far, awfully high, and still always find your ball. How much golf did you play growing up alongside your cricket? Were you one of those classic golfers where it's always the high elbow at the front, it's the classic miss, or were you a little bit more refined than myself and Jim?
No, I didn't play. I didn't play as a junior. I played rugby and hockey alongside cricket when I was a junior. And then I must have been 21, 22 when I took golf up, and then got bit pretty hard by the bug, and still just enjoy getting out as often as I can. And through this lockdown, it was what was keeping me going until they shut it off.
What are the courses like down where you are now? Are there some challenging ones? Are there some wide open ones that me and Jim can maybe get round?
I'm not sure they're that wide. Yeah, they're decent. Member of just a local club to me, and then obviously there's Prince's and St George's down the road, but I haven't found the time to get down there and have a hit round there.
Carl, as part of your development, you were selected to play at the 19s World Cup in Sri Lanka, where you were drawn in a group with the hosts, India, Namibia, and you went 0-3 at that tournament. But how was that experience representing your country at a World Cup at that age?
It was brilliant. I think we played in the first ever game that had super subs as well. Remember them from years ago? I think they're trying to bring them back. It was eye-opening. The Sri Lanka game, we probably should have beaten Sri Lanka. But then we had Angelo Matthews dropped when he wasn't on many, and he went on to get a match-winning score. And I think I got him out off a no-ball as well. So kind of my fault. And then playing India the next day or 2 days later, that was men v boys. It was a completely different level. I think Paresh Chawla, the leg spinner who played for India, is a real youngster. I think he'd just come from his debut straight into the tournament, watching 17, 18-year-old Scottish guys who'd never seen a proper googly before trying to face him. I think he got two or three guys bold leaving. It was absolutely eye-opening to see these guys. And then they were hitting it into the top tier, whereas we were struggling to clear the ropes. You take things like that two ways. You either look at it and think, okay, that's the level, and not that we've ever got to that level. You can try and aspire to that, and you can to get towards that, or you can just say, okay, that's too good, and that's enough for me. And I think we were lucky. There was a few guys in that and the age group before who looked at it and thought, actually, no, I want a bit of this and want to see if we can get to that sort of level.
I've had a look at some of the names that played at that World Cup alongside yourself from the various nations. And if it's all right, I'm just going to run through some of the names. So Moises Enriquez, Jackson Beard, Aaron Finch, Usman Khawaja, Matthew Wade, Dave Warner, Shakib Al-Hassan, Tamin Iqbal, Moeen Ali, Mark Stoneman, Rohit Sharma, Pujara, Chawla, Jadeja, Pandey, Owen Morgan for Ireland, Martin Guptill, Tim Southee, Dean Elgar, Wayne Parnell, Craig Kiesvetter for South Africa, Angelo Matthews, Andre Fletcher, Sunil Nareen, Kieran Pollard, Kemar Roach and Gary Balance for Zimbabwe. So many incredible and recognisable names to come through from one World Cup, but no Namibians. So how did you lose to Namibia?
Because we weren't very good and we got hammered by India and had no confidence. That's what a list. I'm not sure I've sat down and looked through that list before. I didn't realise it was quite so many. It'd be interesting to look at a couple of other World Cups and see if it's like that. But that seems like a good group of players to have come from one age group.
There's probably not many other World Cup classes that have had three people jump nation as well. I think that's probably a claim to fame. But no, as you say, that class, those age groups as for a Junior World Cup is quite incredible. International honours followed soon after. And I think you made your debut against England, didn't you? What do you remember from that day?
Yeah, I made my ODI debut against England. I played a 4-day game in typical Scottish weather, where I think we got 30 overs in 4 days. I made that the year.
That's a dream match.
That's a dream match. and then the England game was rained off after we'd batted. I think if my memory serves me right, I think Gavin Hammett and maybe Colin Smith got some runs. I think the biggest thing I remember was I was batting 11 and I was going out to face Flintoff. And do you remember the old Albion helmets, the plastic ones that had the insides that could come out? As I stood up to go out and bat, that fell out. And I was walking in as I think it was 18 or 19-year-old kid to face Flintoff, absolute hero, bowling 90 miles an hour with a broken helmet, batting 11 on debut. I was absolutely ashamed of myself. That's all I remember. But what experience. And again, it's the sort of thing that I think as a kid, I think because I was just a kid then, I think you probably look at it differently to how I look at games like that now. And that then I probably just thought, oh, it's another game. This is what we should be doing. This is what we want to be doing. And whereas now it's a bit more of an opportunity and you put yourself under a little bit more pressure. Whereas as a kid, you're just going, you're just doing it because that's what you expect you should be doing, probably naively.
You've played for a few counties in England once you did jump this side of the border, none of which were Lancashire to justify any Man U connection, I must add. But Warwickshire, Durham, Derby, most recently Sussex. Where did you enjoy your time the most in those days? I'm sure they were all for very different reasons, different stages of your playing career, but where did it out the most?
I enjoyed my time in the North East up at Durham. I thought it was a brilliant club the first couple of years I was there. Good group of players. We managed to play things, and it was probably the side I played the most for, certainly in white ball cricket. Red ball stuff, I just couldn't quite figure that out. And then I think we settled up in the North as well, and obviously I spent a couple of years after that staying up there, and I think just the whole area we enjoyed. And then Warwickshire for completely different reasons, because that was my first experience of it. And I think I went down when I was 16, 17, and you're in a dressing room that got probably some of the greats of the games. You're watching Ian Bell, Jonathan Trott practice. Your coaches are Alan Donald and Ashley Giles. I mean, you've got Sangakkara, Dale Steyn, who's your overseas. I mean, these are great opportunities to... is a bit of a cricket noffy just to go in and just even be there. I didn't really have any expectations to play, and obviously once I got banned of bowling, there was no chance I was probably going to play or stay there. So I just enjoyed my time and asked as many questions as possible and just wanted to enjoy the chance at being at probably one of the biggest clubs in the world, and then try and learn from that for if I ever got the chance again.
Can we talk about that banning of bowling, or is that still a bit of a sort of what happened? What was the story, and why were you no longer allowed to bowl?
Well, I tried to change my action. Like all youngsters, I wanted to bowl faster. I wanted to bowl with more swing. I wanted to bowl with more aggression, and it kind of coincided with a bowling coach leaving, and then another bowling coach coming in at Warwickshire, and it just developed some really bad habits that ended up with me throwing it. It's that simple, really. It was quite tough at the time, and I went to, I think it was the 2009 World Cup. I think it was after that it became really apparent that something was going to have to be done about it, and quite rightly it got called, and
I had to stop bowling.
Did you have to go through the whole testing and go in the labs with the pads on in different areas, the sticky labels, and pretend at least kept your arms straight, but you're taking 20 mile an hour off your bowling? Or
that was quite weird in itself. It's completely changed, and it's changed for the better. But I got called in the middle of the summer, so then I went back to Warwickshire, and I had 3 months of remedial work, and it's three of the best months I've ever had. And I look back at it and think how lucky I was, because I was travelling day in, day out with the Warwickshire first team, trying to learn how to bowl with Alan Donald as your coach. I mean, that's a great, in some ways that's better. It might have been better than playing in some parts. That's your job for that little 3 month period. But the testing was weird. He then left. I think he went back to South Africa. So I was kind of left on my own. And when I went to the testing, they had to test what was my old action to get their first reading. So I'd done these 3 months' work of remedial, and they said, well, no, we don't need that. We need your base, which they've changed to whenever you get test, whatever your action is at that point. So it's kind of 3 months' work of nothing, of wasted. And then the year after, it changed to if two or three level four coaches agreed that your action was okay, then it was okay to bowl again. So it just seemed it was all a bit muddled of what was the process at that point. But certainly something had to happen, because my action had gone so far that it wasn't sustainable.
Do you think that Jimmy should try and throw it? Because at our level of cricket, he's not going to get called, and it would be nice to see the keeper stand further than 5 yards back when he's bowling in next season.
It'd be nice to see him get out of cricket altogether, so maybe throwing it's not a bad option.
You should try it.
I'm not finding my feet in Red Bull cricket or shorter formats of cricket, so...
Well, maybe you should try it. It's harder than you think to run up and throw it.
No excuses. No, don't encourage him, because he'll take it as a challenge. It's possibly worth mentioning, because you've mentioned Durham and staying up in the northeast there, where myself and Jimmy know you from, and that was your time at South North. You came to join us whilst you were in the northeast. I think you played a little bit in the Premier League already before, and you came to join us, and you took on that seriously important coaching role that really brought the club together at that time. And I think I speak on behalf of the club that whilst you were with us, it completely transformed the place, had a very different aura, and the way you carried yourself around the place and what you did for the club was hugely appreciated and still very much talked about. One thing I took away from playing alongside you or underneath you on occasion was how consistent your approach was to that level of cricket, even though you had played so much higher, even relatively recently and even during that same season. But no matter what happened the week before or who was coming the week after, you still always went into that innings with that same approach, that next innings knock. And I think for the first 5 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, you either scored a ton or got out first ball and still approached it exactly the same. Is that a mindset you take into every game just to get past ball one and then know that once you've done that, you'll score a few runs? Or is it something that just naturally happens?
I think it's funny. It happened when I moved down to Kent as well. I think the first three or four games. I think the first game for my new club, I was hat trick ball out first ball, and then I scored runs. I got 100 the next week, and then I think I was out first ball the week after that again, something like that. And then I think that approach helps. I think it helps that we had such a good side. We did have, I mean, you look through that batting lineup of the northeast of the South North side. It was almost a who's who of northeast cricket, Premier League cricket for a little bit, and then you add in the experience of Marcus North, and then you know that somebody's going to get runs. So it's a little bit easier to approach it knowing you've got that canvas of somebody's going to score.
So Jimmy,
I also think it helps when you. I said this and somebody asked me this on a different point. I think it helps that I've had a lot of ducks. I think I hold the record for most ducks for Scotland. I mean, it's not in ODI cricket. So it's not, I think you start to, you learn. I think if I was 17, 18, 19 trying to make my way in the game, I think it'd be slightly different to if you look at how maybe some of the youngsters coming through in that side might have taken it. They put themselves under a bit more pressure. Whereas I think as you get older, certainly in cricket terms, the way I look at it is if you get runs, you're in form, and if you get out for a low score, it just means you're closer to your next big one. But you can't really, you kind of cheat yourself and you can't really fail. That's the way I look at it now, and I think that just makes it easier to get over.
We spoke to Keaton Jennings a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking to him about his debut for England, where he scored, a game out in Gaul in advance of the Sri Lanka series, and he scored 101 innings, and then he got out first ball in the second innings. He was saying, it won't be my first 100, it wasn't my first 100, it won't be my last, it won't be my first ball, it wasn't my first, and it won't be my last. And he sort of takes a very similar mindset into it, that he could just go out and do it. Whereas Jimmy, on the other hand, finished last season with back-to-back first ballers, and is spending most of this lockdown nervous as anything, waiting for April to come to go out there again and just survive his first ball. So Jimmy, who doesn't know when his next big score is going to come and can't really trust that the big score is coming, what mindset should he take in? Because that advice is very difficult for Jimmy to take on board.
Well, it sounds like he's improved.
Well, he's getting a bat nowadays, so yeah.
Nah, he's a lost cause. There's no advice for him. Head up in there and swing, hope for the best. I think that's where we're going.
You know, if someone had told me this when I was maybe 11 or 12, I could be sat now watching on the sidelines with a pint in hand doing what I'm actually good at instead of standing in the field thinking, Christ, I hope this isn't hitting me. I'm running. Callum, I'm running at the first ball. That's what I've decided. If it's up, it's on.
That's the best way.
Carl, one of the highlights while you were with us for the club, and we won't go into the politics of it too much, was winning that T20 finals day down at Derby, where the guys got over the line. They won that national title and sort of crowned the era that they had over not just North East cricket, but national cricket. You came down to watch the final to support us, very much having been part of the team throughout that season's success, and did a very, very good John Terry impression by getting into all the presentation photos, putting the shirt on at the end and being involved in the media photos. Just how much does that day compare when you came across to join us to the day at the Royal London final, which you actually were part of the team and did contribute to national success there with Durham, obviously a few years previous?
I still probably contributed more in the games I didn't play. I was incredibly proud of the club of winning that. Obviously, we had a good side, but we'd really made a focus of 2020 that year. I know in club cricket during the midweek games and Sunday games, it can be a bit hard to get your best side out. But we'd really tried to make a focus on trying to be an athletic, fit, good fielding side, modern 2020 cricket side, and we really targeted trying to go and win that competition. So to get to the finals day and then go and win it and play some good cricket to win it, I think it was deserved of the work everybody had put in. I've not seen a harder working club side than that South North side that I was playing in. And I'm not sure I've seen a more talented club side. So it was probably justified to go and win it. It was probably just more disappointing we didn't go further in the national one-day comp as well. Because I think it could have been a good year to go and do an unprecedented treble or something like that. I think the side was playing that good a cricket.
Is that hard-working nature something that was almost replicated in that Durham team that won the Royal London the few years previously, were almost maybe not so many household names, young lads, academy products that went on and not necessarily shocked English cricket, but won that trophy where maybe they wouldn't have been backed by that many people?
Yeah, I suppose you're probably right. I think that was for a lot of it, it was some of the team just getting over the line and winning games of cricket. And then the semi-final and the final, it helps having Ben Stokes back in the side too. I think in the semi-final got 140. And then in the final, got us over the line where we were starting to waver a little bit and then bowled and got wickets. I mean, if you put something like that in the side, if you take a hard-working, talented side with the players, you know, Stoneman, Jennings, Borthwick, Collingwood, Onions, Rushworth. They're all, I've probably missed, Gareth Breed's brilliant off-spinner, and John Hastings, who missed the final. They're all superb, very, very good county cricketers. And then you add in a superstar like Ben Stokes to that mix, who was a bit younger then. And he's got this license to go and do what he does. Then it takes that good side, hard-working side, to suddenly a side that can go and win things. And it was a great time to be playing and being involved in it.
A lot of those names that you've just mentioned being involved in are so well-known in the Northeast, but some of them even are linked in various ways to national teams, either early on in their careers or very much so in the present day, either playing or on the coaching staff. We've probably done quite well to avoid talking about that day against England just a couple of years ago when you did have that match-winning knock. It was an incredible day up at the Grange. It was probably one of the last days, or it feels like, where crowds are actually there to enjoy cricket and see a groundbreaking moment. What was that day like in the lead up to it? Obviously, when you're out there, you're probably very much in that autopilot. You don't really realise what's going on. But then when you sit back and you relax in the change room after you've just beaten England, you've just played such a massive part in it. Very special. What was that day like, and what was the sort of feeling not long after?
It's absolutely brilliant. What a day. And you're right. The thing that sticks out the most for me that whole day and the whole thing was a pitch invasion at the end. You talked about crowds, and it's that passion for sport. You watch it. You watch any sport on the TV at the moment. It's brilliant, and you're supporting it, but it's missing that edge of having that fans. And that's the thing. I've never seen passion. I've never seen a pitch invasion. I've never heard noise in the Grange, which is a brilliant venue for cricket when there's a stands in, because there's a bit of a bowl and they're on top of you and it's small. And that atmosphere it was electric, and I've not felt that for cricket in Scotland before. And I think that brought out the passion, and I think that's certainly the thing that most of us, when we talk about that day, that's the thing we remember. That, and it was just a brilliant game of cricket. I mean, if they'd turned up and been bowled out for a low score and we chased it, or we got 370 like we did and they got 220 because they went gung-ho in it, and it was all okay, well, they just batted really well. We were playing an England side who were playing cricket that 370 didn't scare them, and that was our mindset. That was what we'd spoke about it, not specifically about that game, but about the way the game was going for months before that, for the World Cup qualifiers that we didn't qualify for in Zimbabwe. We were in Dubai, we're having team meetings, and we're talking about the way the game was going. We're saying, okay, how do we become a team that scores 350, 330, 350? And these are the conversations. And I think once you get that into your mindset and you practice in a way, and you have a team and you have a captain who leads by example, then days like that, and if you're practicing for that, then it was a matter of a time before we took one of the big sides down, because we'd beaten Sri Lanka in an unofficial ODI, we'd beaten Zimbabwe, and we were playing with the confidence that we knew that if we got it right, then we wanted to beat a team that way. We didn't want to scrape over the line. We didn't want to for them not to turn up. One of our big things was, okay, how do we beat them if they play well? Because it's not good enough just to expect them to play badly, because they're too good for that. And that was one of the big mindset changes that we had, was we want to be better than them if they play well. And it's probably actually led to us losing some games that we should have won. But at the upside of it, we can now play in that way and know that we can, on a given day, compete with some of the best in the world.
An amazing day for Scottish cricket. And I can imagine a lot of celebrations afterwards. Who's the worst drinker in that Scottish team, though? Is anyone an absolute clip the next day? How's the head after a match-winning knock like that as well?
Well, Mark Watt never pulls up well. Terrible the next day. It sounds like a really boring answer, but it's true. We had Pakistan 2 days later in 2020, so we had to be a little bit sensible. It's not to say we went and celebrated it and we enjoyed it and we sat at the dressing room for a long time. A bit unfortunate, England flew back that night, so we didn't get to sit and chat with any of them or anything, but we sat in the dressing room, and then some of the old players that had played in teams that we'd grown up came and joined us in the dressing room and stuff. And that was as enjoyable as the winning moment, because the way the game is in Scotland and the way it's become more and more professional, the guys who were willing to play in their holidays 10 years ago
to get the funding, to get us to a place where now there is, it's pretty much fully professional. Without those guys and the effort they put in, we probably wouldn't have been a professional team to train the way we did to win. So they enjoyed it just as much as we did, and sitting in the change room after having a beer with them was just as sweet as the winning moment.
So no trip to Hive is what you're saying?
There was no trip to Hive. We put that off. It was busy actually. We played Pakistan in two 2010s, and then we flew out to Amsterdam to play Holland and Ireland in a 2020 series, which we also won. So the final night in Amsterdam was quite right. A good night.
Get in.
So you celebrated beating England in Amsterdam, is what you're saying?
About 3 weeks later.
One of the, obviously, Ireland's now full status, Holland's still one of the associate nations, and yourself alongside Kyle nominated for the ICC Associate Player of the Decade recently, which you were pipped to that title by Kyle Kurtzer. Did you ring him to say congrats, or were you a bit bitter in defeat having been pipped to that? Because
First of all, I was certainly not pipped. He was absolutely deserving of it. He's been an absolute titan of Scottish cricket. The way he's played, the way he's led us for the last few years, and the runs he's scored. There was a period probably 4, 5, 6 years ago where he was almost, maybe slightly longer than that, he was almost single-handedly holding us up as a batting unit. So I sent him a couple of texts, and he was quite well receiving of them. And like I say, he was more than deserving of it. You're looking down that list, and I don't think any of the other four nominees really could have anything to complain about or really get that close to what he's achieved in the last decade in associate cricket.
He has led the way for associate cricket, and he's one of the trailblazers in terms of going around the world, making a name for yourself. I guess the other example of that from slightly earlier in the decade is Ryan Tendulskar, but alongside yourself, a lot of the Scottish boys now, even looking at someone like a Rashid Khan, goes round the world, they go to these franchise leagues, they make the names for themselves, which therefore gets the publicity for the nation when they're playing, and it's all brilliant publicity. But what are these T10, T20 leagues round the world truly like? The Big Bash looks amazing, the IPL looks amazing, the Blast looks amazing, but what's it like going to play a 10-over bash in Nepal or in a Bangladesh or wherever it might be, wherever else the journey has taken you? What are they like?
First of all, I completely forgot Ryan wasn't nominated. I've got no idea how he didn't manage to even get nominated, the career he's had in associate cricket, and gone and played in the IPL for numerous years up to, and won the county championship. Amazing that he didn't even get nominated for it.
He's not going to listen to this. You can call him out, you know.
Yeah, no, it's all right, but it was just when you said his name. The good fun, the tough cricket is, so I went to the Afghanistan Premier League, which was held in Sharjah. It was good. There was good cricket. There was some good sides. So obviously, a very talented bunch of locals. And then you add in the overseas players. Two or three of the sides would compete in any of the, or certainly the side that won it would probably compete in most of the 2020 leagues around the world. So you go and see some really good cricket. You're mixing with good players, and I think you can tell I love cricket probably a little bit too much. That if you're a little bit of a cricket badger, then just being around and watching people and learning and seeing how different people train, it's enjoyable just to go and see things like that. Some of the other ones, Hong Kong was good fun. Some good cricket, but also a great city to go and be a guest in. And same as the Canadian Premier League, it was some really high standard of cricket on a tiny little pitch, and just watching some of the world's best just play the innings that they do, and just to even be involved in it was an enjoyable experience.
So sort of when you're going across to Canada and Hong Kong and all these super leagues, were you surprised that one, sort of standard of them may have been better than you were expecting? But two, was there ever a time where you sort of went to a place expecting the lowest of a sort of social scene afterwards and were sort of surprised by maybe a good group of lads and a decent nightlife? Or
I think all the competitions I've been not surprised, because you just have to look at the names of the players. They're good cricketers, and even if some of these guys don't have their best day, they're still going to be good cricketers. And I think done in the right way, the nightlife to it is an important aspect of it. Depending on how you are and what you want out of the cricket, it's a good place to ask some questions. Obviously, you don't want to spend your whole night talking cricket, but if there's a chance and you're in a bar and the conversation comes up, and if you can listen to Chris Lynn and somebody else having a conversation about batting because they're talking about it, and you can overhear and listen to that, and then 5 minutes later the conversation moves on, then if you can remember it in the morning, and these are all things that you can learn where you might not get that opportunity, if you know what people are like. And sometimes after a couple of drinks, they do talk a bit more openly, whereas they might be quite guarded about how they do things. So I think that's, again, an important part of it.
Is that something for you, Carl, that you want to do once things are allowed and a little bit easier, to be a bit more fluid around the world of travel and things? Is that what you want to do a lot more of? And you mentioned going out to Nepal is potentially something to go and do, but be involved in these franchise style leagues. Are there still things that you have a bit of a desire to achieve first before you go down that route?
No, I'm absolutely open to going. At any opportunity to go and play in these franchise leagues, I'd absolutely take. I think the way Scottish cricket is, we don't play enough cricket. So if we can fill the gaps where we don't have games on with tournaments, it's a good way to stay informed. It's a good way to go and test yourself, and it's a good way to keep improving, because we've still got really high ambitions of what we want to try and achieve with cricket in Scotland. I don't think it's a secret that the organisation and the players are really pushing the next few years to try and get full membership, which would take the game to a different place in Scotland. I think part of that is getting more players, not just myself, but more players involved in these competitions, and finding a way of running, or potentially even running, our own 2020 competition where we can get these players into our own country, so more of our own players can get access to it. I think if we can get to that sort of level, then I think the game in Scotland will certainly progress.
Is red ball cricket for Scotland in a recognised test capacity the dream for you? And almost once that's achieved and reached, that can be, you've not completed cricket. That sounds a really cliched thing to say, but so that's where you feel like you've done your stint almost.
I'd be surprised if we tried to get test match status. You can be a full member and just be a 2020 and ODI team. At the moment, associate cricket, there is no red ball competition. It's solely focused on white ball, which for me is a bit of a shame. But obviously the ICC have decided that there's no route in for any of the associates into test match cricket, that the calendar's full and the shop's shut and no more teams are allowed in that way. But there's certainly a route in to becoming a full member in white ball cricket, which is probably, from a marketable view, and getting people to come and watch the game in Scotland is probably where we'd have to start and try and do well there and mimic what Ireland and Afghanistan have done. They've gone to World Cups and won games of cricket. And if we can do that, then potentially we open up the door to being a full member in ODI in 2020. And then if we can get a foot in that way, who knows in 10, 15, 20 years' time where the game could go if it might change to being a test match nation.
Who are the cricketers coming through Scotland at the moment that we should be keeping an eye out of? One or two players that
just broken into the side. Our two left-arm spinners mentioned already, Mark Watt, Hamza Tahir. He's got massive hands, spins the ball. I think he played down at Sunderland last year. They're really exciting and really push themselves on. Below him, there's a young batter, McIntosh. I think they've done some bits with Durham Academy. I might be wrong. Seen him bat a couple of times. He looks a real good prospect. Michael Jones. I've got huge amount of time for him. He's a batter's batter. He just loves batting and loves trying to score runs. And I don't think I've ever seen a man hit as many balls in the net as he does. I think he could have a, hopefully touch wood, if everything goes right for me, he could have a really successful first class career and hopefully a successful Scottish career. There are probably two or three, four names that stand out for me at the moment.
Just want to sort of jump ahead and take you back in a sense to the 2015 World Cup in Australia. How was that as an experience?
That is without a doubt the best trip I've ever to. I think we were out there for maybe 2 months, or maybe it's out of this. It's two of the best. I mean, I didn't score a run in 2015. And I think I played 10 ODIs and got 50 runs. I mean, I was appalling. But the whole experience of going out there, the pre-World Cup camps, being based in Sydney for 2 or 3 weeks before the World Cup, almost seeing how the other half live in the test match teams and flying around to 5-star hotels everywhere. And we had a really good schedule that we played, and then we had most of the time we either had a week or 4 or 5 days off that we could go out and we could experience the country and we could spend time enjoying ourselves out there. And most of the guys had either their wives or partners out there. Absolutely brilliant year. But when I look back at it from a cricket sense, it's really disappointing we didn't win a couple of games. We should have beaten Afghanistan. We probably should have beaten Bangladesh when Kyle got 150. There are two opportunities that we look back at in 5 years or 6 years on now. If we'd taken those opportunities then we might have pushed on quicker. And if you compare that experience to the 2016 World Cup, where we did get our first win as a Scotland team, but it was almost a pre-World Cup that we had to go and qualify from a qualifier to try and even get into the main thing, where I don't think it should be like that. I think if you do the work to qualify for the World Cup, obviously the ICC want to get the big teams on as much as possible to get the revenue in, but it just felt a bit cheated. We played three games in India 2020, we were out there for a couple of weeks, and it was a completely different experience to the experience of going to Australia and New Zealand.
You talked earlier about sort of the gulf in class between your under-19 days playing against India under-19s and men versus boys. What was it like stepping out on the pitch and batting against Mitchell Starc and having David Warner and Glenn Maxwell stood at first slip? I believe you told me a story about that when you were up at South North.
Yeah, it was an experience in one word. one of them wanted to get me in the... I mean, the front pad, and the other guy was stood there about a yard away screaming to try and hit me in the head right in the face, which I didn't really need, because like I said, I wasn't in the greatest of form. Mitchell Starc was bowling 94 miles an hour. It kept coming up on the speed gun. And to be honest, I wasn't really enjoying it. It was that quick that I was almost glad to get down to Pat Cummins' end. It was absolutely... It was phenomenal because it was a big, strong breeze and it was running down. I mean, it was making... Kyle was playing and missing the ball by a long way, and he'd just come off 150 and he was in the form of his life. I should have been batting left-handed or something. I was just my foot wasn't moving or anything. And you've got one guy just screaming at you to try and hit you in the head, and it wasn't the most enjoyable.
Cal, just quickly before we let you go, obviously we're about 11 months out or so, provided everything goes to plan, of the Ashes. And as very impartial of someone who can pass comment between the two of them, who wins that at the moment, this far out, or is it too far out to say at the minute?
I think Australia's record and their bowling attack in Australia, just I know they've just come off that India series where India have won. That's got to be one of the greatest test series wins of all time. And I think England will need to probably produce something close to that to beat them.
Carl, thanks so much. Really appreciate you jumping on. Obviously, we wish you all the very best of luck with cricket moving forward once it returns. But hopefully, Man U, for your sake, and this pains me to say, can win something this year. But I equally hope that Newcastle beat them every time they ever come across them. So
I don't have those thoughts. I genuinely will. I'll be a happy man if we never win another title. I hate Man United with a deep burning passion. Sorry, Callum.
He is a great lad. Comfortably one of the best I've had the pleasure of playing with. Can't wait to see who he ends up playing for next season. Once again, a huge thanks to the guys at Moonrise Cricket for supporting all cricket content we deliver. The support is much appreciated.
Yeah, it was great to hear from Callum there. Definitely one of the best players I've played against in the local league stuff. I know these two lads have had the privilege to play with them, and I've obviously played against them on a few occasions, and it's always a difficult player to play against. But moving on, Doig, what's next?
Yeah, as we said, we're staying north of the border. We had a bit of a catch-up with Martin from the Celtic Fans podcast, 20 Minute Tims, an incredibly well-informed guy talking us through what's happening in the green side of Glasgow this season. Take it away.
It's time to talk football and get a bit of an insight into what's going on north of the border. We are joined this evening by Martin from the Celtic-focused 20 Minute Tims podcast to talk about where Celtic currently are, what's gone on, what needs to happen next. So firstly, thanks so much for your time. Welcome, Martin. How are we getting on? How are you?
Oh, thanks very much for having me. Yeah, fine. Well, fine otherwise, but Celtic-wise, not very good.
We'll get into that. So should we start with the elephant in the room before we work our way through to the modern day and the upturn in recent form? What's been the key factor in the difference in fortunes this year that has led to the point gap at the top being as it is and stopping that 10 in a row?
There's a lot of questions that I could fling at you there. It's been a difficult season for Celtic, but unfortunately, most of the problems have been Celtic's own doing. At the end of the day, all the problems really have been on the pitch. And I think when that's the case, the buck stops with the manager. At the end of the day, the manager's the one that's not getting the results. The performances haven't been good. They haven't been consistent. And Celtic are going on winless runs that I haven't seen in my lifetime, yet we've persisted with a manager. And your Newcastle fans, maybe I was trying to think if there's any examples I could think of in my football watching life where you just persist with something that is clearly not working. And maybe with yourselves at Newcastle, you've had Mike Ashley, but to persist with a manager who's clearly not hitting any season objectives is unprecedented for Celtic in these unprecedented times. And they're just throwing out the rule book and just trying to go in their own way, and it's not working. Anything, it's getting progressively worse.
The blame likely falls at Lennon's door. Possibly some of the players have got some answering to do. I know there've been some defensive frailties, etc. I know he's had some issues at the back end or in goal even with his keeper. What has been the biggest issue on the pitch in terms of whether that's player personnel, who he's picking, whether that's the tactics that he's employing?
It's a mix of everything. Celtic are a team that cannot defend set pieces. We have conceded so many goals from set pieces. We were looking into it recently, and a couple of weeks ago, if you take away the goals that Celtic have conceded in the league, if you take away goals from directly from set pieces, from the second phase of a corner, anything like that, free kicks in, Celtic had only conceded 4 goals in the league. Now, that is not bad. So if you take away the goals we've conceded from set pieces, which was nearly 20, then we're miles off it. Now, if we take away all those goals, Celtic had only conceded a few. They'd be right up there with Rangers right now. But the set piece thing has just killed us all season. We're far too open as well. We haven't had consistency in goalkeeper, in the defence, up front. It's been all over the place. Celtic have played 3 different formations this season, and I still think we're in February, and I don't think Neil Lennon would be able to pick the one he would say is his best formation, and I don't think he'd be able to pick his strongest 11. It's been a car crash from start to finish, to be honest. We could be here all night talking about it.
That was going to be my next question, was actually, does he even know what his best 11 is? I know, as you've mentioned, being Newcastle fans, we see rotation, whether that's injury forced or whatever it might be, and everyone's 11 is probably a different version of the best 11, but wholesale changes. And Duffy seems to be getting a lot of game time at the back, and we know about him from the English game, and he just doesn't seem to have settled in Scottish football.
No, we haven't. As you said, there's been selection problems, but Celtic have used 3 different goalkeepers this season. We haven't stuck with one for a long time. We bought one at the start of the season. He's dropped out recently after starting, 4 games in a row? Neil Lennon said just before January that he's my number one. 4 games later, he's dropped. And we've had a young keeper in. We've had a second choice keeper in. At the back, we've had five different right backs, I think it is, two different left backs. We've had, I think, six different defensive partnerships. We've had a back four and a 4-2-3-1. We've had a 3-5-2 and we've had a 4-4-2 diamond. So we're sticking with a 4-4-2 diamond now, but I'm not quite sure we've got the personnel for it. And anyway, it's not just a defensive thing either. Celtic, they're not creating as many chances as they did last season. The strikers, when they play the two up front, there's been a lot of games this season where we've played 3-5-2 or the 4-4-2 diamond. We've had strikers. We've got four strikers at the club and a few attacking midfielders. Neil Lennon is playing two striker formations and he's playing one striker and an attack midfielder and sometimes having three strikers on the bench. So the selection doesn't work. He moaned a couple of times this season about consistency and how he couldn't pick his same team week in, week out. Recently, we've had the same players available and he changes it for no reason. So I can see why there's not been many partnerships built at the back. As you mentioned, with Shane Duffy, I thought we were getting this no-nonsense defender that was going to come in. Because one of the small weaknesses of Celtic last season is when we played against a physical striker, our two centre-halves, Christopher Julian and Christopher Ayer, struggled against that. So we thought when we brought in Shane Duffy, he'd just slot in there, be that no-nonsense defender. But to be honest, I thought he'd be brilliant. A Celtic fan coming in, he's been probably one of the worst signings in Celtic's history.
It's a label that that no one wants alongside their name, is it? Rangers have been in the news this week for players attending a house party over the weekend, of course, following Celtic's much criticised trip to Dubai post that Old Firm. Sturgeon has come out and told clubs to make sure their house is in order. And a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with Football Mindset coach Rob Blackburn, and we discussed the role of football in boosting morale for the public through these times. What has the public reaction been in Scotland of both incidents and how in the wrong each club and group of players have been?
Well, the Rangers one, there's only been a couple of days, so we don't know quite know the fallout of that. But from what I gather, the players involved went to a house party after the game. So I think when they got, the police came and issued the fines for the COVID regulations, Rangers weren't training the next day, so they haven't been back into the bubble with the players. So I'm assuming they'll need to isolate and they'll be given bans. So it doesn't really affect Rangers, but the difference with Celtic is when it happened to Celtic earlier in the season, Bowling Goalie came on as a sub with 5 minutes to go in the second game of the season. And unfortunately, in the week previous to that, he'd be given a couple of days off and he decided to go to Spain for a night and then come back without telling the club until after the game. So Celtic subsequently missed two league games and had to go into the Ferencváros game, missing those two games. We went out the Champions League and it's been downhill from there, basically. But on the Dubai thing, it was Celtic went to Dubai the day they get beat by Rangers and at the start of January. Now, that left Celtic 19 points behind Rangers. We had three games in hand. So the thinking behind that was, we've done it every year. After that, we come back, we're refreshed, and we go on a great run. To be fair, that has been the case. But to go to Dubai when there's a global pandemic, when already in October, when Celtic players went on international duty, four of them came back, a couple of them had contracted COVID, and a couple of them had to isolate. So that hindered us. So you'd think the board, the management would think, look, let's not take any unnecessary risk this season. 19 points behind, just beaten by Rangers. The optics of going to Dubai for a training camp didn't look great to start with. And to go there and a player to contract COVID was infuriating for the fans, absolutely infuriating. But the worst part about it was Christopher Julian, our centre-half that had contracted COVID. He got injured the week before and was out for 4 months, so there's no way they would have taken him on a training camp. Nope, Celtic took him with them, and he's the one that got it. And 13 players had to isolate, which meant when we got back from there, the week-long training camp, we had them players isolating for nearly 2 weeks, just negating that whole training camp. And the fallout from that was massive. The club was slaughtered, not just by everybody else, but their own fans. Just sheer incompetence from the management who pushed for it and the board who allowed it. And the board had to come out and give us this apology. Peter Law, the CEO, came out and gave us this apology on Celtic TV. And it just infuriated the fans more because he didn't take any responsibility, along with Neil Lennon. didn't take any responsibility. He apologised for it. Then a couple of days later, when Neil Lennon comes out in his press conference, just flamed that whole apology and just basically took no responsibility for it and just went against the owner pretty much and just said, it's not our fault, goalposts were changed. But the big problem with the Dubai fallout was, as I said, Celtic were 19 points behind. We then, with the 13 players having to isolate, dropped points against Livingston and Hibs in the following games. Then when our players came back, we dropped a further 2 points in another game against Livingston and lost at home to St Mirren. So the fallout from that, we dropped 9 points, which right now, if you add those points onto Celtic's total, because they should have beat all four of those teams, we would be 9 points behind with a game in hand and 2 games still to play against Rangers. So even being 19 points behind at one point, it was still sort of in Celtic's grasp, but that Dubai trip has absolutely killed it. And the fans don't feel MD's taking responsibility. We don't feel MD's sort of lost their job or paid the consequences for it.
Lennon sanctioned the trip. He took the players. He was the one who was pictured on the beach having a beer with Scott Brown while they were out there and is rightly copping the criticism that is going for him. Should he go at the end of the season as part of an overhaul that you were possibly hoping was being announced this week? And if he's to go, potentially, the question is who comes in? Who wants that job now?
He shouldn't go at the end of the season. He should have gone months and months ago. There was a point in October, I think it was, where Celtic were beaten 4-1 by Sparta Prague, a team decimated by COVID call-offs. That was at home. That was the end for me. And people before that were all saying he should go. I clung on to that. And since then, Celtic have been dreadful. It's got progressively worse up to January there. I think the board, the problem fans have is the board haven't come out and said either way, Lennon staying or sacked him. What they've done is just tried to kick it down the road. So we don't know. So after every defeat, we're expecting him to be sacked and it's simply not happening. So I fully expect he'll have to go at the end of the season. But there is some thought that the board will try and stick with him. And I don't know how they can even possibly try and get this over the fans because we're coming up to season ticket renewal time. I've never, ever seen this where a club refuse to sack a manager that I don't know any fans that still want him there. And a lot of Celtic's problems this season haven't just been this season. It's been a knock-on effect from the sort of the footballing operation that Celtic run. It's a sort of 2005 model that Celtic are still doing. It is well outdated. It's not up to scratch. We need a total overhaul. We need a new director of football in. We need somebody to run the whole football operations because the fans feel that the chief executive, Peter Law, has too much of a say in what goes on in transfers and all that. It's a very, very outdated model. So Celtic are going to need to have a complete overhaul and we want to see that starting now, but we don't seem to be seeing that. What we're thinking is it's going to happen at the end of the season. Now, it's going to be very difficult to appoint a director of football, a new head coach, get all new scouting in, find new players because Celtic have got 4 first-team players who have only got a year left in their contract at the end of this season. We expect them all to go. They're all big, big players for us and we've got 3 players on loan they could go and Scott Brown's 35, he could retire. So Celtic are looking at maybe 6-7 positions that need to be addressed right now. That's a massive, massive overhaul and waiting to the end of the season could be too late for that because we're going to be in the Champions League again, but for the first time in a long time, we're going to have to qualify through the harder route where we're going to be unseeded. And we've struggled in the Champions League the last 3 seasons to qualify being seeded every round. So if we're looking at it being unseeded, there's not much chance we're going to do it. If we had a settled team, never mind the upheaval we're going to have.
Moving on from the negativity, Celtic have won 4 in a row. They beat St Johnstone at the weekend thanks to a quick-fire double. Lennon said pre-game that he thought the team was starting to play a little more like the team he can recognise. What's changed in recent games? Who have been the key players in that little run?
Well, key players would be Odson Edward. He's our best player. I think he's got 8 goals in 7 games now. He's scored in 6 or 7 in a row. He's a great player, an absolutely great player, and unfortunately we just haven't seemed to get the best out of him. He is one of the players who's only got a year left in his contract, and back in August, Neil Lennon said when we're out of the Champions League, I've got players that don't want to be here. So instead of getting rid of those players and replacing them, Celtic kept them all, and it's not worked out, and Odson Edward was one of them. I think he's a great player. I think he's going to be really hard to replace, and what Celtic should have been doing is getting the best out of him. And one of the ways to do that is we've been playing David Turnbull since the Lille game. That was the last Europa League game. It was a dead rubber. So Neil Lennon, we signed him at the start of the season, but he only made a couple of appearances. Came in against Lille and just was a breath of fresh air. He played in the number 10 position and the guy was creating things, and we haven't seen that for a long time for Celtic. So getting David Turnbull into the team has been the turning point over the last couple of months, because he's just something different. He's got that guile in the number 10 where he can create, he can score goals. He looks like a great prospect, but again, it just goes back to the fact that why was he not playing from the start? Because there's no way you can't see that this guy's a touch of class. So it's been Odson Edward and David Turnbull have been the real ones that have changed it for Celtic recently.
Is Edward the best player in Scotland at the moment?
I think he is the best player in Scotland. Even at the moment, I still think even Rangers fans would say he is the best player. Maybe he's not been shown it all season, but recently we have seen it. It's just a pity it's too little too late. There was speculation that he might go in January, but Neil Lennon came out and says that nobody came in for him, but I fully expect him to go in the summer. And I really hope he does go on to have a good career, because we've seen it in previous season with guys like Van Dijk, Moussa Dembele, those guys that move on to bigger things where you say, look, this guy's too good for the league, and you get that with Odson Edwards sometimes. Sometimes you feel he's playing within himself because you feel he's maybe not getting challenged enough, but I just think if he wants to turn it on, he can. We'd just like to see it a bit more, and I think he will go on to have a great career.
How much would you expect potentially for him in the summer? How much would be a reasonable amount if someone was to come in?
It's going to be a difficult one because he only has that year left on his contract. To get maximum value, we should have sold him last summer. If we were going to do that last summer, I'd be expecting... We sold Moussa Dembele for 20 million, so I'd be expecting maybe a wee bit more for Edward. I think he could have a bit more all-round game than Dembele, but now going into it at the end of the season, with everything that's happened with COVID, Celtic and other clubs sort of maybe cutting the cloth a bit differently, it's going to be a hard one to get maximum value for him with the year left in his deal. There's rumours about 15 million today. I'd be very disappointed in that, but I'd understand it. But if we can get around the 18 million, 20 million mark, we'd be doing well. But I think if you signed him for that, you're getting a bargain.
I was going to say, there's no way he is half the player that Joe Linton is, but moving on. Looking forward to the rest of the season, what can we expect? What needs to happen to make sure that this doesn't happen again next year? I know we've covered a lot of that, but what is the number one thing for you as a fan, as a social commentator on Celtic?
The manager needs to change, quite simply. For me, Celtic, while I think the structure at the club's all wrong and has to change, the manager hasn't been getting results, and that's all it's about at the end of the day. We've got the biggest squad in the league. We've got the biggest wage bill. We've got the so-called best players. These guys were champions last season. They barely lost a game, and to go from that to this is quite unbelievable. We've seen in down south where you are, managers have been sacked and changed, that just making a mockery of Celtic, like Chelsea sacking Frank Lampard, a club legend, getting in a better manager and the results get better. There's been four managers sacked in Scotland. Most of the teams have seen an upturn in form. So Celtic just think they're a unique club, that this is the only club this is happening to, and it's quite simply not the case. We could have changed it. We could have changed it months ago and we'd still be in this title race, but the board refused to. And Neil Lennon's been quite stubborn as well. He thinks he's the man for the job, but he did say back in October, if it's not working, I'll walk. And he hasn't done that. It's not up to him, but it's up to the board to remove him. So the main thing Celtic need is a new manager. Neil Lennon is a Celtic man, a Celtic legend, but after going from Brendan Rodgers to Neil Lennon, the gap between quality in those two guys and the standards is far too big. We need a restructure and we need a head coach in that can develop players, because that's what Celtic are all about, bringing in players, developing them and selling them on. But we've went away from that sort of model the last couple of years just to try and get this 10 in a row, and it's really, really backfired. Complacency has hit, and Neil Lennon, I don't think he's the kind of guy that's going to dramatically improve players and get the best out of them like Brendan Rodgers done. He came in to a team that was faltering under Ronnie Dyla, brought in Scott Sinclair, Moussa Dembele, and the team went invincible and won a treble. It's not that hard to win the league in Scotland. You just need a good manager in there because you have good players there, a couple of additions, but it's going to be a difficult job for whoever takes it, and I'm not really sure who's going to get it, but the first thing we need to do is get a new manager.
Final question, Martin, before we let you go. Always want to raise a debate, and it's an ever-present debate. Where would Celtic finish if they were to leave the SPL and join the English Football League? Would there be a Premier League side? Would there be a Premier League contender?
Yeah, well, not this season, but I think they would be. If they went straight into the Premier League, they'd probably struggle the first season, but after a while, getting all that money in with the stadium, the fan base and all that, I think Celtic could be a big team. I don't think, I'm trying to be realistic here, I think years and years ago, Celtic would have been, if under like Martin O'Neill around that time, the early 2000s to maybe 2010, if we had got a move down south, I think we could have done well. But with the gap in money now is just unbelievable. We are seeing it in Europe that is so difficult for Celtic to compete. So for us to go down right now and have that massive gap between all the other teams, I think Celtic would be doing well to stay in the league and then possibly push on after that. But we need to have everything in place and all the right structure. But I've no doubt if the club were given 5 years down there, they'd start to creep up the table and challenge. Whether they could ever go on and win it, I'm not quite sure because of the gap that's been, it's massive, isn't it?
Do you think fans would embrace that? Do you think they'd be happy to have a crack at it?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't think I would be. I think it'd be interesting to see if there was some sort of European league or something. But at the end of the day, Celtic are a Scottish club for me. The best times I've had supporting Celtic are winning trophies or when we're in Europe getting big results against big teams, being the underdog and beating a team. And if we go down to England, I just feel we'd just be another team down there and you'd maybe miss those days. I think Celtic are a club all about winning things. Going down there, it just takes that away from me. And I quite like being the underdog in Europe sometimes and having that. And I like Scottish football. I watch a lot of English football, but I like Scottish football. I don't want to go down there and just it would only be about the money for the club. Like, how much can we bring in? That's not what it's about for me. You can talk about selling Moussa Dembele for 20 million. I'd rather see the guy on the pitch because we don't invest the money properly. So if you're talking about going down south, it would be interesting. But for me, Celtic are a Scottish club and I just think stay where your roots are.
Well, Martin, thank you so much. And obviously Celtic are and have been and will continue to be one of the best in Scotland. And I'm sure they will be back to their glory days very, very soon.
Oh, no, thanks very much for having me. It's hopefully I didn't rant too much because there's a lot I could have went into. There's just been a disastrous season that none of us can believe.
Massive thanks to Martin. What a guy. So well informed. A great little insight there. A season to forget for Celtic and probably a fair assessment on the issues and what they need to do. Who wins their title first, by the way? Man City down here or Rangers up there?
I'm going to go with Rangers as much as I'd much rather Gerrard win it before Man City win, so I'm going to go Rangers. I think I was saying yesterday when we were talking to him or when Doiger was talking to him, I was looking to see if Rangers had even dropped a game, if they'd lost a game, and they hadn't, so which I was still surprised at. I know that that's obviously a pretty obvious stat, but I know Jimmy was saying something like they haven't conceded 10 goals as well, so yeah, Rangers all day for me. Man City will win it and by with ease, but Rangers will win it.
Rangers to win it at Celtic Park, City to follow a couple of weeks after. I think what's more interesting in probably both countries, especially up in Scotland, this could piss the Celtic lads off, is the race for second. Hibs catching them up there. That position's not safe for them. Who comes second in England? Leicester.
Yeah. I just hope Liverpool finish in the top four. That's all I'm bothered about now. I'll take top four.
What a fall from grace.
Don't talk about
things
talk
you
about.
Love to see.
You're 17th.
Aye, we expect to be there.
No, that's success, Tinners. That is success with our lot. And you are the worst champions in history. So anyway, closing time, prediction time. It's the Australian Open has been going on down under. Some quarterfinals have already happened in the men's game. Some are still to go. So our prediction this week, or my question for this week, is who is going to win the men's singles Australian Open?
Who's playing?
I'm going to go...
Who's playing, Andy?
All the men, all the big men, all the names. Djokovic, Nadal, they're still in it. Rublev, Medvedev, I think. A couple of others, Jimmy. Just pick one.
I'm going to go for Rublev.
I'll play it safe and go with Nadal. Thanks, Doig.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go Djokovic because I can pronounce his name. But good episode, eh? Great little insight into what's happening north of the border. As always, please follow, support and share the podcast to help us grow. At whatsnext.pod on Instagram and at whatsnextsport on Twitter. Thanks to our guests. Gentlemen, as always, an absolute pleasure. Look after yourselves.
See you later on. You do.
See you later.
I'm the cat with the bass and drum going around like bum, bum, bum.